Ellis v. County of Stanley. Mr. Anderson, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Terry Anderson. With me today at council table is Tim O'Brien, the Halpin O'Brien, both in Lathrop, where I am of counsel and some of my partners. We represent the appellant, Dylan Fales. He is appealing a decision of the Madison County District Court, which dismissed his action under Section 13911 of the Vehicle Pursuit Statute on the basis that Dylan was not an innocent third party and thus not entitled to recovery under that statute. On the evening of February 8, 2014, Dylan was a passenger in a car driven by his friend Brian Irish. The boys had been to some parties, well, they were both underage, they were both 19 at the time. They'd been to some parties of drinking beer, they had alcohol in their car, and after being at a party, they left, got in the car, and started driving. They drove south on Highway 560 in Stanton County. Officer Peterson, a Stanton County Deputy Sheriff, observed the car. I think he saw it fishtail as it left the place where the party had occurred, and started following it, although he did not at that point activate his lights or do that. They went south on Highway 560 to the junction of the intersection of County Road 842. And at that point, the cars were going more or less at the speed limit, and Sheriff Peterson's car had got fairly close to the Irish vehicle, but not enough to see exactly who was in it and who the parties were. At that intersection, the Irish vehicle turned right and did not signal its turn. Officer Peterson got to that intersection very shortly after that, turned, and as he stated, immediately activated his lights, emergency lights. I didn't have a siren, or if he did, he didn't activate it, but the lights went out. At that point, the Irish vehicle accelerated and began to increase speed down going west on County Road 842. Officer Peterson testified that as soon as he saw that, immediately upon activation of his lights, he accelerated as well. Under the Williams case that this court decided, we know that at that point, looking at what happened, a pursuit began, because the Williams court defined a pursuit as activation of the emergency lights and acceleration after the vehicle that was accelerating away. So that a pursuit, I don't think there's any question that a pursuit began at that point. The cars went west on 842, and between the intersection of 560 and 842 and the Madison County line is a distance of, I guess, about 2 miles. If you look at Exhibit 33, there's a chart that has all of these times and distances put on it, but that's about what it is.
Before we go too far beyond your argument about State versus Williams, it seems to me you're inferring that in that case it was determined as a matter of law that lights plus acceleration equals pursuit. But in that case, the district court found there was a pursuit. Didn't all we say wasn't clearly wrong?
Oh, I think that's true, Your Honor, but...
And here the district court found there was no
pursuit. I disagree, Your Honor, with respect. I don't think the district court said there was not a pursuit.
Okay, just no innocent third parties.
Exactly. I think if you look at the order of the district court, it said the district court actually said implicit misstatement is that there was a pursuit. The district court said Dylan lost his status as an innocent third party at a certain point.
Okay.
And as a result, the decision is clearly based upon whether or not Dylan was an innocent third party.
So the pursuit beginning or stopping really doesn't make any difference to the outcome of this from your standpoint. It's,
well,
was he or was he not an innocent
third party? I think it's important from the point of view of Dylan, it's important that he established there was a pursuit because that's one of his requirements for recovery under the Act. All I've suggested to the court is that there isn't any real controversy about that, either because of Williams or also because both Officer Peterson and his boss, the chief, the sheriff of that county,
reluctantly agreed, yes, under the law, this was a pursuit. So that, I don't think there's any question about that. I empathize, I'm only to show that that's one of the things we want to show. But in fact, the real question here is whether Dillon was an innocent party. As the Irish Car proceeded west on 842, just after it passed, I think it's East Lake Road, which is about just under a mile west of 842, Dillon, threw some beer cans out of the car. He admits that. It's foolish of him to do it, but he admits that he did it. Officer Peterson, after he activated his lights and radio, he was in pretty much constant radio contact with the sheriff's office, said that when he radioed in that he was activating his emergency lights, about 25 seconds later, radioed in that he saw some of these containers, beer containers, beside the road. He did not testify, nor is there any evidence that he saw who threw those beer container cans out.
Does innocence depend upon the mindset of the pursuing officer?
I think it does. Your Honor, I think that the question of whether or not an officer was in pursuit is probably to be determined objectively. That is to say, I think the Williams Court affirmed the district court because looking at it objectively, a pursuit means basically putting your lights on and accelerating after it. The question of whether or not Officer Peterson was trying to apprehend Dillon, that question, which I think is vital to this case, is, I think, one that can only be determined by asking what did Officer Peterson intend to do. So I think that, I know that's contrary to oftentimes what we do in these probable cause kinds of situations. I understand that, Your Honor. But I don't see how we can apply the rule in jura to this kind of situation without looking at Officer Peterson's intent. So let's look at that. The question is, was Dillon an innocent third party? I don't think the district court made any findings about innocent. I think under 13911, the innocent and, as I say in my brief, the innocent and third party status of a passenger in the car, which this court said is somebody who qualifies as a potential innocent third party. I think that the innocent part of it goes to whether or not that passenger is in some way or other encouraged the driver to do what the driver is doing, to try to escape and accelerate and drive carelessly. There is no evidence, and nor do I think the district court made any finding, that Dillon in any way basically encouraged Irish to do what he did. The only evidence we have about Dillon's participation in the decision to accelerate and flee from Officer Peterson was his statement that Irish said, "What should we do?" And Dillon said, "I don't know." He was afraid.
Well, what about, why was the officer sort of surveilling individuals leaving this location to begin with? What's the evidence in the record on that, and does that have anything to do with innocence?
I don't know that there is any particular evidence. Perhaps the officer might have testified that he heard there were drinking parties going on in a trailer court or something. I don't know exactly, but I frankly don't think that matters, Your Honor, because his decision to pursue came about after the basically traffic violation that occurred at the junction of 842 and 560. It was unrelated to all of these other, whatever other things he might have been looking at. And I think that really this is a Werner case. We pretty much relied on the Werner case in the district court. This is a Werner case because even though Dillon was committing a crime while he sat in that car, he was. He was in possession of alcohol, and he was a minor, and he shouldn't have done that. So too was the passenger in Werner.
But, counsel, the Werner case, the district court found that there was an innocent third party. Thus, the standard of review that is very deferential to factual findings went in the claimant's favor. Here, the standard of review goes the opposite direction. How do you deal with that?
The way I deal with that is to say that in this case, it is absolutely clear that the district court may dismiss this case and found that Dillon was not an innocent third party because he found that Dillon was not a third party in the sense that the law means third party under 13911. He did not make a factual finding that Dillon encouraged this vehicular actions by Irish. What he said was that Officer Peterson expanded the scope of his intent to apprehend people and occupants of that vehicle once he saw these beer containers.
Is this an error of law that you are asserting?
Yes.
That the trial court said not a third party, so it wouldn't matter if he's innocent or guilty of other stuff.
I think the court found that the fact that Peterson saw some beer cans alongside the road without any other evidence showing how they got there, who threw them out, and so forth. It's absolutely clear on that. I think the court found that fact that Peterson saw that, now changed this from a Werner case to a Jura case.
And remember, weren't those beer cans, to put it in the vernacular, on the passenger side of the road?
They were on the road, Your Honor. He went by them, Officer Peterson went by them, probably going 60 or 70 miles an hour. The district court found, I think correctly, that the Irish vehicle went up to 86 miles an hour, and so too did the Peterson vehicle, so that it's hard to say what he saw. What he does testify to is that he simply said, I saw them. He says, I didn't see them come out of the car. I just sort of assumed they did. And, you know, what if in the Werner case, the officer had said, well, I assume that people in a passenger car like this would probably have illegal drugs on them. And he'd have been right. And Officer Peterson was right that the beer cans came out of this car, but he just assumed it. He did not find that. And I think that puts this squarely in the Jura case, in the sense that in Jura, the pursuit was activated by the sheriff and police officers basically saying, that's a stolen car. Everybody in that stolen car could be responsible for it. Part of it, we're after all of them. Okay, that makes some sense. You could see how the legislature would say, none of the occupants of that car are entitled to protection. But that isn't how this pursuit began. And let me, if I can, read what I think is really crucial to distinguishing this case from Jura and putting it in the Werner. This is from the Jura court opinion. A police officer's grounds for seeking to apprehend occupants in a vehicular chase situation must have a reasonable basis in the law and facts. Such a basis clearly exists in this case because the vehicle was a stolen vehicle, as compared to, for example, a chase starting with a traffic violation. This case began with a traffic violation. Consider the elements of that evening. Officer Peterson didn't drive his regular cruiser that night. It was so snowy and the streets were so treacherous that he went and got an SUV with four-wheel drive so that he would be able to traverse in those streets with safety. This is the same person who saw somebody not signal to turn right on the road, hit his lights, and caused him to go up to 86 miles an hour on icy roads around a corner that is absolutely treacherous. It seems to me that this is precisely the situation that the legislature had in mind when it passed 13911. I'm sorry to have overstayed my time, Your Honor, but thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much. Mr. Valentino, good morning to you.
Good morning. If it pleases the court, my name is Vincent Valentino and I represent the county of Stanton, Nebraska. Judge Kuby had this case, tried it for almost a little over 2 days. He made findings of fact and conclusions of law that are very consistent with the evidence that was presented. The standard of review in these kinds of cases, as I understand this court well knows, is deference to the trier of fact. There isn't any evidence that Judge Kuby missed in this case. This is a case where two young men left a party with a 30-pack of beer in that vehicle, and one of them decided it was time to get rid of the evidence. And that was Mr. Anderson and Mr. O'Brien's client. Now, I can envision all kinds of circumstances when police pursuits might happen, where people are chucking evidence out the windows. Those folks that are in that vehicle, where evidence is being thrown out of a vehicle, not only are littering, they're also destroying evidence of whatever their crime might be. There was absolutely evidence in this freshly laid snow of these beer cans on the passenger side of the right side of the road. You can see the photographs in that case. Deputy Peterson and two other officers were assigned to go back to the scene by the sheriff to photograph where these beer cans were thrown. 28 of them were collected. The beer case, Busch Light beer case, was collected. Bales admitted that he controlled the electronic side of passenger side, and he was the one that threw the evidence out, and he gave the reasons why he threw it.
Does the deputy have to know who did what in the car?
He doesn't. And in fact, because of the darkened windows, he wasn't sure how many people were in that pickup truck at the time. All he knew was evidence is being tossed out of this vehicle. And the case law is relatively clear, in my opinion, regarding the ability of law enforcement to stop a vehicle where they see criminal activity involved. With all due respect to the plaintiffs in this case, the facts of this case are such that Mr. Fales simply lost his status as innocent third. And the judge at page 7 says, similarly, when Fales threw the beer out of the pickup truck, which Peterson observed, he lost his status as a potential innocent third party. Even though Officer Peterson did not know it was Fales who was a passenger in the truck, or even if there were any passengers in the truck, Peterson's purpose of apprehension broadened to include any and all persons inside.
So you would say that if they were driving the pickup and Fales told the driver, speed up, then he'd lose his status as an innocent third party also?
He would be provoking also. Mm-hmm. He would also be provoking or persuading. And in fact, Fales admitted he was constantly turning around trying to see where this vehicle was. Irish really wasn't sure that he was the one that was being pursued by this officer. They were far enough apart. He thought there was somebody between he and the other in the police vehicle that was actually maybe being sought. But once he hit that county line and got onto that pavement, Irish just took off. I mean, but there's an eyewitness that heard that the motor of that vehicle as it came down that East Norfolk Avenue. He looked out. This Mr. Reed. He looked out. He saw that truck just streaming by. And the first thought in his head was, that car's not going to make that curve. About a minute later, he sees the deputy's car with its lights on, but going about 40 miles an hour. It was clear from the dispatch records, everything that we put into this record, Judge Kuby's findings were correct, except in one respect. He should have granted my motion to dismiss or directed verdict at the close of that evidence, because you cannot have strict liability claims in the Tort Claims Act when it's clearly defined as not as a tort claim. There's a number of cases that I addressed in my cross appeal that are there. It's jurisdictional for this court's determination.
Wind that up a little more specifically. What's the logic that leads to the allegation that it's jurisdictional? How do you?
Because 13903-4 defines what a tort claim is under the Nebraska Tort Claims Act. It is based on the Federal Tort Claims Act, that Daylight versus U.S. case. That was the ammonium nitrate case where the United States Supreme Court said the definition of tort claim is error or omission, not strict liability. And they tossed out the strict liability claim that was being made because the United States Navy had commissioned ships and had ammonium nitrate in it, blew up, killed a bunch of people, destroyed a bunch of property, and so forth. That case was later reaffirmed in Laird versus Nels. There's also, our court has cited Daylight five different times in five different cases that we've had before this court, and they've all dealt with the discretionary exemption. And the reason the discretionary exemption was called into play here is because you can rely on a statute, a rule, or regulation as an exemption or immunity. Judge Kubi pointed that out in his original order back in November of 2015. I went back and came right back with an amended counterclaim that specifically poked into that tort claim definition. You cannot have an error and omission in our tort claim definition and then have a strict liability statute the way this thing came into existence. The whole history of that act is set forth in our brief. It's set forth in the record. Judge Kubi did a great job of analyzing that record that we put before him that started in 1981. 30 years we've dealt with a statute that is a strict liability statute that got planted into the Political Subdivision Tort Claims Act.
Has this court ever had the opportunity to review that argument before?
No. This court has never reviewed that argument before. And when I had this case, I thought it was time, finally, after Warner versus Platt County, that I argued before this court, to figure out how this statute ever came to be. And the history of that is laid out in the brief. It started with LB 414. It was a Judiciary Committee review by Senator Chambers' bill that was called the Strict Liability for Police Pursuits of Nebraska Law Enforcement Procedures Act. It was 18 different sections. That bill never came out of committee. Did Senator DeCamp's bill, LB 76, which set up, I think it's now 29211, set up the standards of procedures and education and so forth for law enforcement pursuits, came out of committee. When that bill was on final reading, Senator Chambers sought to stick that his bill that never came out of committee onto that bill. Senator DeCamp said, no, not going to do it. But what he did was he took another bill that had come out of the Insurance, Banking, and Commerce Committee, LB 273, and he let him glom onto that. They pulled it off of final reading to select file, and then Senator Chambers put his strict liability language from one section of his bill, it was Section 18, and became Section 31 of 273.
So they decided that's the horse to ride.
That was the horse that Senator DeCamp gave him to ride, because that was Senator Kemp's bill as well.
So it's been 30 years, does the lapse of time somehow diminish that argument?
Does it make it any less unconstitutional?
Is there a statute of limitations that's applicable, and if so, what would it be?
I wouldn't think that there would be. You don't have legislative acquiescence or judicial acquiescence to an unconstitutional law. If it's unconstitutional, it's unconstitutional. You cannot tolerate, just as a matter of common sense, putting strict liability into a Tort Claims Act when the Tort Claims Act itself is specifically for errors and omissions of government as if it was a private person.
When did the county's claim accrue? You're raising a claim for declaratory judgment that the statute is unconstitutional. When did that claim accrue?
That claim accrued the minute Fails started throwing evidence out that window.
Not when the legislation was passed?
No. There's no limitation on looking at a statute's constitutionality.
Haven't we said otherwise?
Pardon?
Haven't we said otherwise?
I have not seen a statute of limitations apply to a constitutional challenge on something that is so antithetical to the very idea of what a tort claim is. And that statute has been continually poked on and revised at different points in time. But it's still there, and it's still a problem, and it still suffers from the same problems that have existed.
Your argument that it's jurisdictional is critical to your constitutional claim in the sense that if you prevail on your argument about innocent third party, that's the only way that we would have to reach the constitutional argument, correct?
If you decided to reverse Judge Kubi, you'd have to look at the other argument. What I'm telling you is, on page 257 of this record, volume 2, I laid out the jurisdictional question front and center on a motion to dismiss.
Well, to flip it the other way, if we if we were going to affirm Judge Kubi on the plaintiff's appeal, would we have to reach your cross appeal?
You don't have to, but it's there. Right. And it's going to be there for a long time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there any time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. On we go.